Join with me the words in the bulletin as we light the chalice. In the light of truth and the warmth of love, we gather to seek, to find, and to share. A reading from Matthew 6, verses 19 to 23, part of the Sermon on the Mount. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If the eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?
Let's pray. Come here to celebrate our relations, to seek a deeper frequency, to find that chord where our single notes unify in harmony. We are here to create space, to sanctify time, to see ourselves as we are. Vulnerable, strong, hurting, helpful. We gather here for each other and ask them in. Amen. I don't know how many of you were here the last time I preached, which was the curious incident of the misappropriated suit. This is the suit that I was looking for. I got the right one today. I found it. It was in my closet. Being that this is likely the last Sunday I will occupy this pulpit for some time, I thought it only fitting to begin the sermon, not with a confession, as is my habit, but with a word of gratitude. I want to thank you all, and the members of the worship committee in particular, for allowing me to preach so frequently this spring and summer. It has been a blessing to me, a great learning experience, and I think a very positive step on my road to ministry. So thank you. Truthfully, this has me a little sad and wistful, but I'm also very excited for two reasons. One, it means that I can rest. Writing and giving sermons is like any worthwhile exercise. It invigorates and exhausts at the same time. And especially now that my summer hospital chaplaincy internship has, just this past Friday, come to a close, I am righteously, if I don't say so myself, exhausted. The other point by which I am excited for this to be my last time up here for a while is the reason behind that circumstance. Soon, and at long last, we are going to have a minister again. And that is truly exciting. Given the trauma ensuing during the aftermath of Davidson's dismissal, I have been impressed by the commitment exhibited by the members of this church, committee participants, the staff, the board, workshop leaders, and volunteers. In rocky waters you have kept the ship afloat. And for that, you all deserve a tremendous amount of praise. So, if I may be so bold, on behalf of all of you, I want to thank all of you. However, unlike me personally, we corporately cannot rest. In fact, the time is coming to double our efforts, to increase our commitment, to invest our character even more fully into the realization of the potential possessed by this church, which is at last the aggregate talent, energy, and disposition of the people on either side of you and the people on either side of them, and so on, which includes you. Yet, to this point, all that energy remains potential. All this commitment remains inert. In the hospital, I have come to learn that there are those patients who possess a talent for surviving. Then there are those who possess a talent for thriving. With the later group, the thrivers, it seems like they come to the hospital almost for the sole purpose of teaching me something. Their disposition and perspective are such that I find myself changed for the better without being taxed. They have life in such abundance that it overflows their being and energizes mine. Now, with the former group, the survivors, yes, they have a sometimes miraculous talent for surviving, but not for thriving. And a talent for surviving means that they are frequently sick. To be sure, they are to be admired for surviving some very difficult circumstances. But they do not thrive. My friends, we have survived. How then are we to thrive? When I was a little kid, my parents hung a sign over the toilet in my bathroom. I know that's a strange segue, but it'll make sense when I tell you that the sign read, "If you don't know where you are going, you'll probably end up somewhere else." A worthy sentiment, and it occurs to me only now how curious that this was hung over the toilet. If you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up somewhere else. I suppose this was my parents' sense of humor and their way of saying, with a nudge and a wink, "Hey kid, try aiming." Of course, there was a spiritual and existential message here as well, and that was not lost on me. And I think therein is a clue to how we may thrive. It strikes me, though, that wanting to know where you're going and knowing where you're going are two different things. And perhaps this is the difference between surviving and thriving. After all, the process of discernment, discovery, and decision-making can be every bit as arduous as their execution of their conclusion, if not more so. This, among other things, is what our new minister is here to do, to help us do, to discern, discover, and decide where we are going and indeed who we are. The leadership is hers. The task is ours. It reminds me of a story I was recently told. And as I understand it, this is a true story, though the source is a bit dubious of character. Whether or not it actually ever happened is beyond my powers of evaluation. Nonetheless, it was an inspiring story insofar as it resonated perfectly to the point which I am speaking today. As such, it may be that I have made most of it up. It's still a true story. So, as my friend tells it, he grew up in a family that was not exactly traditional. Nothing radical, necessarily, just an atmosphere created by the parental versions of the free-thinking 60s. The family was as functional as any other, which is to say, not very. And it's my understanding that they had less trauma but more drama than many families, in the sense that there was no violence per se, no abuse, but some wildly divergent personalities that were, in some ways, encouraged. But of course, this led to some problems, and these problems were chiefly embodied and brought to bear by their annual summer vacation. You see, what they liked to do was pack a bunch of stuff for any and all potential circumstances, pile the five of them in a car, and set out for something impressive, if vague and ill-defined, like a coast or a region. And they reveled in the freedom to stop along the way, wherever the interest struck them. And truth be told, they had a lot of interesting experiences going down a few rabbit holes. Unfortunately, it was frequently the case that one of the siblings had to remain behind. Either one had to work off community service hours, or another had to attend summer school. And what's more, invariably, they would find that their publicly vague destination was personally not so obtuse, just uncommunicated. For instance, when they determined that they were going to hit the West Coast, they each had a different idea of what that would ultimately entail. One thought that meant Venice Beach, while the other thought that meant sipping lattes in the rain shadow of the Space Needle, and another thought it meant SeaWorld. Thus, arguments were inevitable. Now, once they were resolved, it was frequently the case that they didn't even have the necessary money to get all of them into the main attraction. And this was the case because they had spent most of their funds chasing interests along the way. Now, almost invariably, these excursions would end in hurt feelings and pervasive disappointment. So finally, my friend took the initiative to sit the family down together and pick a particular, however peculiar, destination. This was more difficult than he thought, but eventually they hammered out an itinerary that was oriented to a rather more specific target, one which they could all be excited about while still allowing some wiggle room, though not too much, for flights of fancy. The difference was this fancy was normed by the destination, not the other way around. Now, the part that was really interesting to me was that year, the whole family got to go. The kids were more focused. They stayed out of trouble and in school because they did not want to be left out this time. The two who were old enough even took part-time jobs to contribute to the vacation fund. And since they had determined to go overseas to really shoot for something grand, The family realized they had to cut back on eating out, give up cable TV, etc., which in turn had the unforeseen effects of the family eating healthier food while creating more time for homework, each other, creativity, friends. In other words, determining a destination had a systemic effect, and the trip went well. Now, I heard that story, and I immediately thought of our Unitarian Universalist tradition in general. I thought of our congregation in particular, and I thought of my own faith. You see, as effective as our tradition, congregation, and faith are, they can be so much more so. What we need is vision, a holy vision of who we are and what we do. So recall today's reading. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. This is from the Sermon on the Mount, as it is described in the book of Matthew. And note here that the eyes are themselves instruments of illumination. They illuminate that which they light on. Vision illuminates. Now, in this case, the eyes are connected inward, toward the body, so to speak. And as is the case in much of the Bible, the clause, so to speak, is crucial. For here, it is enough to understand that the eyes are essentially instruments of discovery, discernment, and empowerment, for they do not merely perceive, but themselves illuminate. Meanwhile, the body spoken of here could well indeed be the biological body, or it could be any system of which you are a part, like a church. Essentially, I take the passage to be in line with what so much of the modern sciences are currently saying, namely, what you see, so will you be. So what is your vision? A word of warning here. Vision alone is not sufficient. In fact, it may be absolutely detrimental if that vision is distorted. The passage reads, "If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light." But it goes on to reveal that if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. And we're talking about spiritual vision here in this passage and in this church. Distorted vision leads to darkness. It leads to idolatry, a charge that is easily leveled at most of the incarnations of the Abrahamic traditions, that is, at most monotheists. But idolatry is a charge that can be leveled at each one of us as individuals as well. That is to say, the self can be an idol, can distort our vision, and plunge us into darkness. I'll give you a personal example from my recently concluded stint in the hospital as a chaplain. Part of the program was to get together with my fellow interns and uncover our blind spots as a way to help us relate to our patients. As part of this process, we read a book by the German neo-Freudian Karen Horney. And as she sees it, a great deal of neurosis can be attributed to the gulf between the idealized self and the actual self. For our purposes today, consider the idealized self as a distorted version or vision of your character, an idol or false god. Most all of us have this distortion. When the process of life inevitably confronts you with the gap between how you are and how you think you are, you find yourself in the midst of a psychological crisis. The severity of the crisis is variable, depending on any number of factors, but what is assured is that the reaction to the threat for such an event is always experienced as a threat. The reaction to that threat is entirely out of proportion to the reality of the situation. You are effectively insane, and more to the point, in no small amount of pain. Consciously exploring this gap with the quite necessary help of others or one other is also initially painful. And here you'll just have to take my word for it. It's painful. And yet while the pain is acute and psychologically invasive, it is also corrective and preventative of an equally painful, frightened, and chronic way of life. I had the opportunity this summer to be confronted with my own neuroses of the idealized self, and I think I am better off for it, if a little bruised yet. And this is not to say that I am now perfectly aligned between my actual and idealized self at all. Rather, I'm hoping to illustrate one of the pitfalls and benefits of vision as it applies to the individual. If your eyes, so to speak, are good, your body will be full of light. You will see the idealized self for what it is. However, if your eyes are bad, your body will be full of darkness. And you will think that you are your idealized self, and pain will ensue and endure. Thus, discernment is critical. As I hope I just illustrated, this process of discernment is not merely a challenge to our corporate self, that is, to our spiritual home at First UU. It can and should be a challenge to our most intimate sense of our individual characters. As such, I can guarantee you this: pain lies ahead. For we are about to embark on a journey of self-discovery that will reveal those places where we have been lying to ourselves as a community. And if we have integrity, we will pursue those lies until we find where they are rooted in our individual selves. That action makes this place truly a holy place. That action makes this time a holy time, and this event truly sacred. Do not pretend that you can bring distortion into this venue without destroying the event and all the intentions of those that participate in it. That may sound melodramatic, but you come here to feed your soul. What are you feeding on? This place is powerful, merely by virtue of our shared attention. On top of that is the intent of that intention or attention. What you bring here is what you find here. So where do we start? I will offer two possibilities. They are not the only possibilities, but they both attempt to articulate where we are as a community. They are baselines from which we may begin as a global body, a local community, and as individuals to envision a particular way of being and thus graduate from merely surviving to the more powerful mode of thriving. The first possibility is a statement of faith, as articulated by one of the modern sages of our tradition, Dr. David Bumbaugh. Some of you had the pleasure of hearing him offer this statement from this very pulpit during the keynote address he delivered at the 2008 Spring Southwest District Conference. In the midst of our diversity, Dr. Bumbaugh has noticed that we have a stunning amount in common in terms of our faith. Now, I have only a little time, so I'm going to paraphrase. We believe that the universe is the expression of a process that has evolved from singularity to multiplicity, from disorder to order. We believe that the earth and all who live upon the earth are products of the same process that swirled the galaxies into being, that we are expressions of that universal process. We believe that all living things are members of a single community, and we hold the life process itself to be sacred. Therefore, we affirm that we are called to serve the planetary process upon which life depends. We believe that in this interconnected existence, the well-being of one cannot be separated from the well-being of the whole. We believe that the universe outside of us and the universe inside of us is one universe. Because that is so, our efforts, our dreams, our hopes, our ambitions are the dreams, hopes, and ambitions of the universe itself. We believe that our efforts to understand the world and our place within it are an expression of the universe's deep drive toward meaning. And we believe that the moral impulse that weaves its way through our lives is threaded through the universe itself. And it is this universal longing that finds outlet at our best moments. We believe that our location within the community of living things places upon us an inescapable responsibility. We are commanded to serve life and serve it to the 7 × 70th generation. We believe that those located in the margins have important contributions to make, and that in some curious way, we are all located on the margins. We believe that all functions to divide us from each other and from the community of living things is to be resisted in the name of that larger vision of a world everywhere alive, everywhere seeking to incarnate a deep, implicate process that called us into being, that sustains us in being, that transforms us as we cannot transform ourselves, and that receives us back to itself when life has used us up. Not knowing the end of that process, nonetheless, we trust it, we rest in it, and we serve it. The second possibility that I offer is from a much less esteemed, though I hope no less earnest, a source, namely me. One of the first runs in the pulpit, I invited one of my first runs in the pulpit, that is. I invited you all to take part in a ritual that I felt embodied our faith. And if you will indulge me, I would like to return to it. It is not only a part of my vision for our movement and our congregation to develop embodied symbolic articulations of our faith, it also seems like coming full circle, that I will leave on a similar note to how I began. So if you would, please take a moment to move so that you are all sitting next to one another. And if you could, those of you who are more mobile, please sit near folks who may not be as able to move as you. Now take a moment to look at the people that you find yourself next to. These are the people with whom you share your spirit and who will cooperate with you to find a vision that carries us from surviving to thriving. Look at them with good eyes. For what you see, so you are. For now, if you would hold out both of your hands, palm up. This is a gesture of openness, of asking and receiving. And if this next gesture makes you uncomfortable, that's okay. Honest religion often takes us out of our comfort zone. Keep your left hand open, but with your right hand, place two or more fingers on the wrist of the neighbor to your right. Right over here on the side and a little under the thumb. If you are on an aisle or sitting by yourself, you could hold your hand open and feel the qualities of the air or feel your own pulse. You may now choose to close your eyes or not, however you are comfortable. Breathe in. Exhale slowly as if you were meditating. Keeping that breath intentional, consider how touch affirms the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Our touch embodies acceptance of one another and is a first step towards the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice. Consider that through your fingerprints, you can feel the pulse of your neighbor. Which is to say that through your singularity, you touch the life force. Finally, see if you can coordinate your breathing with the rhythm of your neighbor's heart. And let that coordination expand in your imagination to include the rhythms of everyone here. As nodes on the interdependent web of all existence and facets of the sum that is greater than all these parts. Listen now to breath and blood and life. At one time, be grounded. Be here. Transcend. Amen. Now, if you would take a minute and say thank you to the folks around you. This is your church.
We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again.